You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom, and you're listening to the American Hour. Thank you for joining us today. And, of course, we've got a great guest today. I'll get to him in just a second. But my lovely co-host, Paula Lazan Osman, is with us, as well as Dick Birnbach. Paula, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Tom. We've got a real field temperature here in Boston, a 91, and it's mostly sunny and extremely hot.
Yeah. Well, Dick, you're in Central Florida. What's the temperature like there?
It is beautiful, Tom. Low humidity, and I think we're sitting about 88 right now or 90.
Wow, low humidity.
It's just gorgeous out.
Amazing.
Minnesota
okay, I'm down
is sitting at about 130 with the temperature and the humidity.
Yeah. There you go, the heat index. And, you know, you see all over the news today, especially on the Internet, that D.C. on Friday is going to hit 116, except they left the fine printout. Heat index. So, in other words, it feels like 116. I've been in 116, 120-degree weather, okay? Most people haven't ever seen that, so they don't know what it feels like. So I don't know how the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Department is putting this stuff out, why they're doing it. I think they want to bolster the idea that it's hotter than ever before, it's just getting so hot, and we're going to burn up the world because it's all our fault. The reality is it's only going to hit about 100, which is not unusual, for some time during the summer, especially late in July, in Washington, D.C., and the eastern seaboard. So it's a bunch of baloney that it's going to hit 116. It's not. It's not even hardly possible. Plus, we know from NASA data that the last 10 years there's been a cooling trend. So they just hate that. The libs hate the fact that they're wrong. And the fact is they're always wrong because they have to lie about stuff to try and make their points. They never stand on substance, but that's another story. In any case, so if you see out there in the news today that it's 116 in D.C., not true. The heat index, which is based on a whole bunch of different factors, which are very subjective, quite honestly. So in any case, but we've got a great guest on the show today, Ambassador Stanley Escudero. He's been a three-time ambassador. I'll let him talk briefly about that as he introduces himself. He was in Iran under the fall of the Shah. And actually, I believe you were in Iran prior to that, Ambassador, working at the embassy, and you predicted this fall coming. And I don't think that was such a popular topic, but you predicted it. You knew it was going to happen. And you've been a diplomat all over the world and political liaison to the government, or diplomatic liaison to various organizations, but I'll let you introduce yourself and get this stuff right. Ambassador Escudero, thanks for joining us today.
Well, Tom, thanks very much. It's good to talk to you and to you also, Dick.
Thank you, Ambassador.
Aunt Paula, happy to have a chance to talk to all of you. I'll say a word or two about myself, but Tom basically covered it. I was a Foreign Service officer for 33 years, three times an ambassador in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Azerbaijan. These are all countries which were part of the Soviet Union until that nation obligingly fell apart in 1991, and then they became independent. I did serve in Iran from 71 to 75 as a political officer in the embassy, and I returned in 78 and 79 undercover, largely because I could speak Farsi pretty well, and I looked a bit like an Iranian if I disguised myself a little. And I had some contacts in the opposition, which others didn't have because it was not popular or career-enhancing in those days for a Foreign Service officer to know the opposition to the Shah too well. In any case, it was an exciting time, and you know, perhaps Tom and I will sit down over a beer and tell war stories about it someday, but today, I guess I just wanted to come on and talk about issues related to the debt. I could probably talk about the debt ceiling question. I could certainly talk about the Middle East and Iran if that turned you on. But just now, I thought it would be worth mentioning that having served a number of years in Washington, D.C., I'm convinced that the natives of Philadelphia and New York, each of them disappointed that they would not be the permanent capital, chose the place they could think of that had the worst climate in all of the country. And while it may not normally be 113 up there in Washington, just now with all the hot air that's being put out by the Congress, it is quite possible that in the case of Washington alone, what you're seeing is anthropogenic global warming, or at least anthropogenic district warming. But that'll go away once the Congress goes into recess.
Very good point. Yeah, if we can take back the Senate and the presidency, we will. Just that alone will stop global warming, absolutely. Well, Ambassador, I want to ask you a question because we've seen a lot of turmoil over in the Middle East. We see countries that are tired of the tyranny and dictatorship that's been ruling over them, and whether they're actually moving in the direction of democracy or not, that's another question, and who's really behind this. But that's certainly the foil for this whole purpose of rising up and rebelling against these dictators. My question is, and I'm going to lay a little groundwork here, is are we going the way of some of these Middle Eastern countries? And here's why. We've got liberals that were in charge of both houses in Congress and the presidency, still the Senate and the presidency today, who hate the Constitution. I mean, really despise it. And they try to tear it down by saying, well, it's a living, breathing document, which it is not at all. It can't possibly be, because then there's no rule of law. If you can change something willy-nilly from day to day to fit your own desires and constantly reinterpret it to fit what you want, then there is no rule of law. So that's a false premise to begin with. But with that said, they would like to not have it. They want to be able to make up the rules as they go, just like we saw this last Democrat Congress, not even put together a budget. No budget. They appropriated money, but no budget. Absolutely irresponsible. And the Senate hasn't done anything in over 800 days in the terms of proposing any kind of a budget themselves. So they want to just be able to move forward in whatever way they feel is appropriate for today. So whenever I ask liberals, well, what protection do we have from tyranny? Some of them really don't care. They're like, tyranny? That sounds good to me. I don't mind that if somebody's, dictator ruling over us. But most of them say, well, we'll just vote people out of office. If the very people that are becoming tyrannical don't want to leave office, then we don't have elections. They can stop the elections very easily. And Tom, that'll never happen. Well, look, if it does happen, what is our protection? Well, their default is always this. Liberals' default is this. Well, the people will rise up and take the country back. We're seeing that go on in the Middle East right now. It's bloody. It's a mess. It's not easy. And a lot of people die. And a lot of people died in the Revolutionary War. So that's really the liberal solution is a lot of people are going to have to die, and we're just going to have to start over again. Why should we even start over again? So my question to you is, Ambassador, are we going the way of the Middle East and becoming eventually a tyranny to where we're going to have to do what the liberals envision is the way to get out of a tyranny, and that is a revolution?
Well, Tom, I wouldn't want to draw direct parallels between the United States and the Middle East. I mean, first of all, every country in the Middle East is different. It's a mistake to talk about an Arab Spring or an area-wide transition to democracy. Each one of those countries will approach whatever it is they're transitioning to in their own way, subject to whatever influences determine the future of their country. And it's worth recognizing that virtually none of them have any experience with democracy, so it would be silly to assume that what will come out of it will necessarily be democracy as we understand the term in the West. But as for the United States, the Constitution is our rock. The Constitution is much more than a guideline. The Constitution is not just a set of principles. The Constitution is a template. It's a description of how the government is meant to work, and most importantly, it is a series of protections for the rights of the states and the people against the possibility that a central government will become overweeningly powerful. If you read the Federalist Papers, you will see that that was one of the hardest arguments that the founders had to make in convincing the states to join together and surrender some degree of their individual sovereignty under a constitution which was much more centralized than the Articles of Confederation had been. My concern, however, is that for over a century now, the central government has been becoming ever more powerful, salami slice by salami slice by salami slice, and the rights and powers of the states have diminished, as have those to some degree of the people. I'm particularly concerned that the power to legislate has weakened. The Congress, under the Constitution, is supposed to be that branch of government which has the power to legislate. However, activist courts, beginning with Mr. Justice Marshall, have gradually taken on themselves the power to legislate from the bench by interpreting, in effect, what laws mean and what the Constitution means. Some degree of interpretation is necessary, but the degree which we are now experiencing and have been experiencing now for some decades has created what amounts to a second legislative branch of government. That aside, because we've been living with that, this president now, more than any other, has begun to legislate via executive order, even in cases where Congress has already decided to the contrary, as with some of the EPA decisions, for example. And what you are seeing is the president, in effect, also usurping some of the legislative powers of Congress. Most recently, they've been talking about a way to try to use an interpretation of the 14th Amendment to give the president himself the power to raise the debt ceiling without referring the matter back to Congress, if Congress won't vote a rise in the debt ceiling. And that's frightening, because if he thinks he can raise the debt ceiling, he probably can also raise the amount of borrowing, and the two are not the same thing. The way I see it, there is a risk that our government, our central government, could, through this process, become much more powerful than the founders ever intended. That, I suppose, it's already done, or than the people want or will accept. If it ever reaches that point, I'm not sure what would happen. If you look to the Declaration of Independence, you would see that at that stage there would be a call to rebel, but rebellion now is a very different thing from what it might have been in 1776. And frankly, it's not something that I would want to contemplate at this point.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Now, when you mentioned Chief Justice Marshall, one of my favorite books written by Henry Adams, I think a great grandson of John Adams, made it very clear in his book, and he did some unbelievable research. I went through and just looked to see all the research he did just to come up with writing this book, and it's amazing. But he said that Chief Justice Marshall and the other Federalist chief justices in the Supreme Court had every intention of interpreting the Constitution to fit what they believed how the government ought to be run. But they lived in a time when the founders that actually wrote it were there. Can you imagine being a Supreme Court justice and going, let's see, what do you think the Constitution means? Well, let's just go down the street and ask James Madison. He wrote it. No, they didn't care. They did not care. So when you think about today, our Supreme Court trying to figure out, okay, what does this really mean in the Constitution? We didn't have that liberty, but it doesn't even matter. Think about how bad it was back then when the founders actually were still alive. They didn't care. Today, it's just too far out of control. So we need term limits on our Supreme Court justices and our Federal Circuit Court justices, just like we needed on the Congress. But then you also mentioned the 14th Amendment. We've talked about this frequently, and I went over it yesterday, and I don't want to bore people with it because I've gone over it a couple times. But the reality is this. If the president were to unilaterally raise the debt ceiling by basically adding more debt to the country, he would be violating the 14th Amendment. It's very simple. Anybody just go Google it, read the 14th Amendment. He would actually be violating the 14th Amendment if he were to raise the debt limit. So this whole notion that he can use the 14th Amendment, he wouldn't be using it at all. The 14th Amendment is not an after-the-fact amendment. It's a prior-to-the-fact amendment. In other words, Congress better be sure when they raise the debt that they're doing it in a way that the debt cannot be questioned. It's not an after-the-fact invoke the 14th Amendment. It's already been invoked when the debt ceiling was raised before by the Congress. It's already been invoked. So anyway, sorry about my little rant.
Tom, I accept your interpretation. I have no doubt that any move like that would be challenged, and given the founders' very clear mindset with respect to limiting the power of the federal government and the very plain declaration in the 10th Amendment, I would imagine that any effort by Obama to do such a thing would be found to be illegal, but that would take several years.
Yes, exactly.
In the meantime, we would be that much farther in debt.
Yes, exactly. Well, let me ask you this, Ambassador. A lot of people are kind of divided on this. You know, should we raise the debt? Should we not? What do you think, number one, is actually going to happen? What do you feel in your bones that this Congress is going to end up doing? And what do you think the right answer is?
Well, I think the Congress will raise the debt ceiling. And I think that is not just the right thing. I think it's the only thing we can do. Philosophically, I would like not to do it. But as a practical matter, 42% of all the money that we spend in a given year is borrowed. 42% of the budget is borrowed. And if you look at the budget, some 56% of it is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on the debt and so forth. If you add those two numbers up, you get what, 2% left over for everything else?
Yeah.
If you don't borrow, you've got 2% of the budget, if you see what I mean. You take 42% out of it, you spend on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, you do the debt servicing, you pay the interest, and you've got 2% of your budget left to pay for defense, to run the federal government, which some people might like to see shut down for a time, but never mind, for everything else the Fed spends money on. And that just isn't possible.
Yeah.
So the debt ceiling is going to have to be raised somewhat. That's not the major issue, in my view. I think that's going to happen. I think what ought to happen is that there should be a series of phased decreases in the rate at which the amount at which the debt ceiling is raised, and those should be tied to a series of phased increases in cuts, in spending, so that over a period of years, maybe as long as 10 or 15 years, you have both a growing level of spending cuts and a decreasing level of borrowing. At the same time, you have fundamental changes to the tax structure. I would prefer a fair tax, but if that can't happen immediately, at the very least, you need to have elimination of taxes on capital gains and dividends and severe reductions in the amount of tax on corporate income so that you can encourage the development of the private sector, which is the great engine, the great driver of the creator of new wealth in this country. And if you do that, then you will begin to grow tax revenue to the government from the growing economy that will be produced in that way, and that will offset some of the need for borrowing as well, because it will increase the amount the government has to spend. And finally, and perhaps most importantly in the long run, there must be a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, which would be phased in coordination with the cuts and increases that I spoke of a moment ago. Mm-hmm. The reason we have to do that is because when President Obama said that we don't need a budget amendment to the Constitution, we don't need a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution to do our job up here in Washington, he was either telling a very bad joke or he was exposing an incredible level of ignorance. Historically, the Congress has hardly ever, virtually never, since 1944, been able to live within its means. There is no reason whatever to assume that it will do so in the future unless it is forced to. Any kind of enforcement mechanisms which the Congress now imposes upon itself can be removed by future Congresses, and they will be. No Congress will cut spending unless it is forced to do so, and the only thing that will force it to do that is an amendment to the Constitution. So there we
are. Yeah, I agree. Well, now
Mr.
I heard an
Ambassador.
Interesting theory. Go ahead, Dick. Go ahead.
I've got a question. It's probably way out in left field or whatever. Maybe it's even out of the ballpark.
Okay,
for music, like
it's going to be in right field, but go ahead.
thank you. Whatever Congress passes, the new Congress can throw out. What if we had something in place with the Constitution and amendments that nobody in Washington had the authority to change anything without a vote of the people? Would that help?
You mean a referendum of the people would be required in order to change what? The Constitution or some element of law?
To change the Constitution to make to take out amendments that were put in that will help the people. Like you said, they can make changes now that are good, and once we get a new Congress in, they can throw them all out. We have to stop being able to make the changes without our say.
Well, the way you do that with respect to the Constitution, Dick, is you have both houses of Congress. I think it's a 2/3 vote in each house. A vote to put forward an amendment to the Constitution to the states. Once that's done, the process is in play, and a future Congress cannot withdraw that unless and until the states have had an opportunity to determine whether or not they are going to approve it. If 3/4 of the states approve it, the Constitution is amended. And then there isn't a damn thing a future Congress can do about it except try to re-amend it to remove that amendment to the Constitution, as was done, for example, with the Volstead Act, with Prohibition. You know, the Constitution was amended to make liquor illegal, alcohol illegal, which, of course, just enriched criminals. And then after a few years, they figured out it didn't work, and they amended the Constitution again to eliminate the Volstead Act, and done was done. But it was the same constitutional amendment process that was followed both times. I think the founders were right to do it in that way, because when you refer the matter to the states and you give the people in 3/4 of the states the opportunity to vote on the subject, you are referring it to the people, but you're retaining the power for the states as well. If we put it to a referendum, there would be questions about how the question is phrased, how it is conducted, who conducts it, who counts the votes, all kinds of things like this. Not to mention the timing of it. If one decided that a referendum were to be conducted when conditions were especially harsh, the people might vote one way. If conditions were somewhat better, they might vote another way. I think it's much better to keep what we've got. It's worked for us for 235 years.
I see your point.
I knew you would, Dick. Well, hey, I love Thomas Jefferson, and I've found some stuff I printed out a long time ago, and I'd forgotten about some of these things. One of the things I did is you were talking about, you know, Ambassador reducing really the role of the federal government in commerce and that sort of thing as far as trying to manage our economy. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government authority to manage our economy. And even if the economy is faltering, it's not their job to fix it. But in any case, people have come to expect that. But the Thomas Jefferson, one of my favorite quotes is, "The true theory of our Constitution is surely the wisest and best, that the states are independent as to everything within themselves and united as to everything respecting foreign nations. Let the general government be reduced to foreign concerns only, and here's the key. Let our affairs be disentangled from those of all other nations except as to commerce, which the merchants will manage the better, the more they are left free to manage for themselves." And Jefferson knew it back then. I want to challenge any libtard out there, any single one of them, to tell me they know more than Thomas Jefferson. They're smarter than Thomas Jefferson, because they're not. No, none of them will ever say that they're smarter than Thomas Jefferson. And then finally, the quote that I had forgotten about was Jefferson asked the question and answered it then, "What has destroyed liberty and the rights of man in every government which has ever existed under the sun?" The answer: the generalizing and concentrating all cares and power into one body. So in other words, a highly centralized government, a dictatorship, a communist party, on and on and on. That is what destroys the liberties and freedoms and rights of man. And that's the direction we're going. That's what the liberals want. They want to generalize the Constitution, which Alexander Hamilton made it clear. It's not to be generalized. We have specific enumerations of power in there for a reason. So it's not to be generalized. And concentrating all the cares. One of the reasons I believe that Obama would like to grow the size of government and he doesn't care about the debt that we're going to go into is, in order for the federal government to manage all of our affairs and, in essence, eliminate the state governments, it's got to get bigger. It needs more money. And so I think that could be the concept. The idea is we're going to push and push and push until the states really aren't doing much. And we had a guest on yesterday talking about Agenda 21. you know, that really falls into line with eliminating state governments. State governments are really there just to administer what they're being told to do and no longer actually making decisions on their own. So in any case, I had to throw my Jefferson stuff in there because I love Thomas Jefferson. And, yes, people argue, oh, but, you know, he owned slaves. Listen, he wrote the Declaration of Independence, which says that all men are created equal and that we have unalienable rights given to us by God. He did that for a reason. He did that to lay the groundwork to eliminate slavery. He also wrote in the original draft a scathing discussion on slavery, but it had to be taken out because the southern states didn't like that. And second of all, most people don't know this. In his second administration, he proposed a constitutional amendment. He wanted Congress to take this up, just like the amendment you were talking about, process you were talking about, Ambassador, to eliminate slavery. Yes, in Jefferson's second term, so we're talking in around 1807, he proposed this, to eliminate slavery, a constitutional amendment. So anybody that wants to try and bring Thomas Jefferson on down, bring it on. I can answer that. He was a genius, a very smart man, a God-fearing man, contrary to what people want to believe, and he was opposed to slavery. So anyway, there we go. So, all right, see, that was a great answer on what we should be doing and what we need to do. What do you think is going to happen with some kind of a compromise? Because this is what I believe is going to happen, that this government, our Congress is going to come up with a compromise that raises the debt ceiling, does a bunch of ghost cuts, things that were already going to go away. We already saw John Boehner do that. You know, it was going to be, I'm going to eliminate $100 billion in this continuing budget resolution. Then it's down to 60, then 30, then it's, what was it, eventually supposed to be like $20 billion, and it ended up being more like $300 million. Going to be a bunch of ghost cuts that aren't really going to amount to a hill of beans, and then we're just going to have more debt. And the president's going to ride this out like, hey, see, I got involved, I exercised leadership, and I helped solve the problem, when in fact he didn't at all. But where do you see a scenario like that, Ambassador, taking us? How long can we just keep kicking this can down the road?
Well, this is the real problem. The truth is there are realities which are driven by the inexorable laws of economics and the interests of our international creditors, which make it virtually impossible for us to kick the can down the road much farther. But I do see a compromise being the result of the current deliberations for two reasons. One, the founders set up our system to be one which reached decisions through compromise. That way you avoid conflict. And it's worked very well in this country, except for the period 1861 to 65. The second reason, being perhaps even more immediately compelling, and that is that the Republicans control the House and the Democrats control the Senate and the presidency. So there is not going to be a solution which is not at least minimally palatable to both sides. That doesn't just imply, it mandates a compromise of one kind or another. That's why I say that whatever happens eventually will probably contain some form of tax increase. I don't want to see a tax increase, and I assume it can be an increase on perhaps the very, very wealthiest among us, let us say those who make $5 million a year or more. I'm just pulling that figure out of the air. Or it can be an increase in tax revenues through the closing of loopholes or something like this, but there is going to have to be something which will be satisfactory to the Democrats in the Senate, and which will enable Obama to tell his base, looking toward the coming election, that he did indeed manage to increase taxes on the rich, even though a lot of those same rich pour money into his coffers on a daily basis, especially the captains of Wall Street financial industries. But be that as it may, the compromise also has to include an increase in the debt level, but I would hope not one which would be of the size Obama wants. Obama wants an increase in the debt ceiling, which would relieve him from the necessity of borrowing money again until after the election, because he wants to dodge the political responsibility for the doing of it. It's dangerous for him, for the Dems. It's dangerous for the Republicans, too.
Right.
But it's a fight that I think needs to be fought. And the problem that I have with the discussions that are presently underway, especially the solution put forward by the Gang of Six, is that while you're going to have as a result of this, some level of debt ceiling increase now. All of the spending cuts are referred to committees in the House and the Senate down the road. They're things right. that will happen in the future.
Right.
I remember when Ronald Reagan was president, he was promised by the Congress $3 in spending decreases for every dollar in which taxes were raised. He agreed. He raised taxes. There were no spending cuts.
Absolutely. That was Tip O'Neill, yeah.
George H.W. Bush violated his, read my lips, no new taxes pledge and may have cost himself a second term when the Congress agreed that, again, they would cut spending by an amount greater than the raising of the taxes. He raised the taxes. There were no spending cuts. You cannot trust the Congress to make good on any promise it might make to do spending cuts in the future. You remember the old comic strip Popeye? There was a character in there called Wimpy, and his line used to be, "I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today."
Yeah.
Well, of course, he got his hamburger, and he never paid for it.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Congress is real good at eating hamburgers. It's not much good at paying for them. And that's my concern, and that's why I want to see a balanced budget amendment. We need some kind of a thing which will hold the Congress's feet to the fire. The Gang of Six proposal doesn't do that. Charles Krauthammer has a better idea, I think. He puts forward a proposal for a $500 billion increase right now with a series of cuts. And that increase would get us through the end of the year. But if the cuts weren't made by that time, the whole issue arises again in a negative way. It's a way of keeping a club over Congress's head.
Yeah.
And if we don't do something like that, we lose any way of really influencing them.
Right.
Because then they'll just go back to lying about the term they use is spinning, but it's really a form of lying. About the nature of their votes and why they cast and how what they did was for the best interests of the country and how it's all going to work out in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
The trouble that we have, as I keep saying, is that our debt now is so high that if it keeps going higher, a couple of things are going to happen. One of the first things that will happen is on the 3rd of August, and this will happen anyway to some degree, the Fed has to buy a substantial number of, I think it's $159 billion, but don't quote me on that figure. It has to buy new debt. It has to sell more Treasury bonds.
Yeah.
In the past, because the Fed has been buying its own bonds, 70% to 80% of those that were sold, it was able to hold down interest rates, but it quit doing that on
right.
the 30th of June. That means that the market will set the interest rate for those
right.
bonds, and it's going to be higher than 3.5%. It might be as high as 6%. I don't
yep.
know. I'm just guessing. But if we have to pay almost double the interest rates on all the new bonds we sell, and we have a substantial number of bonds we have to sell, before very long, the level of interest, the debt service, the level of interest that we're paying on our debt is going to go up and up and up. The absolute amount is going to go up and up. And our debt will begin to increase faster, even if we don't spend more.
Right. In
because
fact, that
we're paying more for the new debt we have to take on.
That very fact, there have been some articles out there that show
happen,
that those increases will actually eliminate the savings that they're talking about, the cuts they're talking about.
That's
it will
exactly
virtually just
right.
wipe those out. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And the big rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, the Chinese agency, Dagong, these will all downgrade us from AAA to AA+.
Yep.
If that sort of thing happens or if there is not a proper solution, because our creditors will come to fear that that sooner or later the Fed will have to start buying the debt again.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's massively inflationary because the Fed creates money out of thin air when it does that.
Yep.
And they will conclude that their debt will be repaid in devalued dollars worth, who knows, half what it was when they lent it to us, which could bankrupt them. They
yep.
aren't going to have that.
Right.
And so in order to be sure that that won't happen, they themselves will put pressure on these organizations, the rating agencies, to lower our debt. And they will begin to move away from the use of the dollar as the global reserve currency,
yeah.
Which will further weaken our economy and cause massive overnight inflation. There are small rating agencies already. There's one called Eakin Jones, which has already downgraded our credit rating to AA+. This is a very dangerous situation for us, and it is not one where the Congress can play its usual political game of trying to shift the responsibility and the blame to the other side. They've got to get together. They've got to agree on a compromise which is best for the country and put their political careers on hold.
Yeah.
That's a lot to ask of any politician.
When have they ever done that?
But it's time.
Yeah, they never do that. Well, there's a reason for having a debt ceiling. It's to stop us from going down this path. You know, they make it sound like, the media makes it sound like this debt ceiling is just something, oh, well, we'll just raise it, you know, and how come Republicans don't want to raise it? We have it for a reason, to stop us from bankrupting ourselves. And so we should utilize it and not raise the debt ceiling. But in any case, you know, here's my thought, my proposal on what we really ought to do, and that is to say, okay, we'll raise the debt ceiling because we know this government is incompetent, incapable of trying to slash and really truly slash government spending and the size of government. So we'll raise it for now, but what we're going to do is this. We're going to put a direct proposal into this debt ceiling bill that says we're going to start selling off assets. And there's some economists at George Mason University that took a conservative view. In other words, what is legitimately, realistically possible for this government to sell off? TARP assets, for example, $180 billion right there. And they came up with $2.4 trillion. So this is what I would say. You hand the president a bill that says, we're going to give you, as you said, the ambassador, you know, whatever a good number would be, $500 billion to raise the debt ceiling for now. But you've got to start selling all of these listed assets off. And as you sell them off, you first pay off the $500 billion we just gave you, and then you continue to pay down the debt. Or then you can use the rest of the remaining money, so it would be about $1.9 trillion, for running the government, et cetera, and we will then start looking at how we can cut spending and the size of government, and as you talked about, phased-in cuts, start doing that over the next 2 years, because if we don't, we will not raise the debt ceiling the next time either, or at all. So this is the opportunity to get it right. Do it now, but sell off assets. You know, Ambassador, I see people all up and down my street having carport sales and other things like that, not just because they like doing it or they got some excess stuff. They're trying to get by and make some money. And if you go on Craigslist and eBay, it's just full of people selling stuff, just stuff, trying to make a little extra money to help them get by right now. But the government isn't willing to do that. They're too good. They expect us to do that, but they're not willing to do it. And that's why I think we need the government to feel a little pain, because it doesn't. And as you said, raising taxes, all that. I see liberals all the time, and I talk with them every now and then, saying, but Tom, it's just not fair. We've got first of all, a progressive tax rate is immoral, number one. And no liberal has ever proven to me that it is a moral thing to do. But second of all, it won't. If you tax at 100% all rich people, and we're talking the millionaires and billionaires like the president likes to demonize. He always needs a straw man. It won't even come close to taking care of a portion of the annual deficit, not the debt, the national debt, but just the annual deficit. So, you know, the numbers are out there. If you tax everybody at 100%, they're making $67,000 on up to the millionaires and billionaires. You'd barely cover half of the annual deficit, barely. So my question for you is, Ambassador, if we get away with taxing the rich some more because it's only fair, it's not going to be enough. It's not going to make a dent, as you said earlier. It's not going to make a dent really in anything. What's the next step? Who are we going to go after, and whose money are we going to have to go after next?
Well, Tom, my idea that the very richest among us could be taxed a little bit more was really a sop to the Democrats so that they could find it politically palatable to vote for this particular thing.
Sure.
I don't regard a steeply progressive income tax as moral. What I regard as immoral in terms of taxation is a situation in which some half the people pay no tax at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they have no skin in the game. They're not stakeholders in the system then.
Right. But they get to vote.
All they learn how to do is to sit there and hold out their hand for government benefits of one kind or another.
Yeah.
These people need to be prodded into doing something to support themselves, except for those who are very, very old or manifestly incapable because of physical disability of one kind or another. But you can't tell me that that constitutes 50% of the population of the country. That's just absurd.
Yeah.
Right. We have two and three generation families who have been on welfare of one kind or another and haven't the slightest intention of getting off of it. And that's just wrong.
Yeah.
That's
correction, Ambassador.
Immoral, and it does a disservice not just to the country, but to the families who live that way.
Yeah.
As to where they're going with all of this, Tom, I'm concerned that the government spending machine doesn't know any limits. It will crunch up anything that drops in its maw and spew it out in an inefficient way.
Yeah.
I'm also concerned that our president and many of those around him are Marxists of one kind or another.
Yeah.
And they are inclined to use the spending power of government as a way of weakening the free market system and the Republican system, which we have had in this country for 235 years, so that they can shift it farther to the left. There are those who believe, and I'm beginning to become one of them, that part of the purpose of this administration is to create a crisis so great that the people will acquiesce in the accretion of ever greater power to the central government, even at the cost of their own freedoms, in return for what will turn out to be a hollow promise to make things better.
Right.
Never let a crisis go to waste.
About the future of the country, from that perspective, and I fear that the impact of the crisis resulting from the debt ceiling and the possibility of ever higher interest rates, inflation, and a shift away from the dollar as the global reserve currency could be the tipping point moving in that direction.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Well, you know, anybody out there gets their hands on the book Rules for Radicals, this is precisely what, as you read through it, you'll see this is what the Democrats are doing, and it's precisely what the president does.
Yeah, it's Saul Alinsky's gospel, and Alinsky, of course, was a convinced Leninist.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And let's see, he dedicated the book to the devil.
Lucifer.
Yeah, he said, lest we forget, at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical, from all our legends, mythology, and history, who is to know where mythology leaves off and history begins, or whatever, yeah, another typical atheist. But the first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom. Yeah, wow, that's great. Hell, he won hell. That was a great, great move there, Lucifer. But anyways, a guy that dedicates his book to Lucifer and a guy who spends 20 years in a church with a Marxist, that's what black liberation theology is. It's Marxism twisting the Bible and Christianity to give your people, whoever they may be, and it started in Latin America, an upper hand and try and convince the wealthy that they have done something wrong and that they need to bow to you and give up all their wealth and you take it, basically taking other people's wealth. So Marxism and black liberation theology combined, or liberation theology combined, comes up with black liberation theology. And he sat in that church for 20 years and somehow didn't know what was going on. Then he really is a moron. He's not very bright at all. But we know he's smarter than that. So he absolutely knew what was going on. He follows the tenets of Saul Alinsky, an atheist and absolute radical that hates the middle class. And that's what he talks about in his book. In order to destroy the middle class, you got to become a part of it and destroy it from within. And that's what the whole book is about, is how to destroy the middle class. So that's where really this guy wants to go. He might not phrase it that way, destroy the middle class, but he wants to make everybody the same. And I don't think he's really spent much time in Cuba or Venezuela or some of these other countries where everybody really is the same. They're all poor. They don't have anything, but they're all the same and everything's equal. And as long as there's bread and milk in the grocery store, they're happy. But when it runs out, what does Castro or Chavez say? We'll have some tomorrow. Don't worry, but it'll be free. Wow, what a great way to live. So that's who our president is, and one of the reasons we've got to get rid of him. I quite honestly think, you know, we've got problems with Al-Qaeda and terrorists and just nut jobs. I would say that our own president is the greatest enemy of the state that we have because of his philosophies and the direction he wants to take this country. And he made it clear before he took office, we're going to fundamentally transform the United States of America. Well, fundamentally transform it into what? A better place. Yeah, he talks in platitudes, but he won't give us any specifics. So here's what I've been putting out on Twitter and Facebook, and it's got some pretty good response so far. Somebody in the media needs to ask the president, Mr. President, do you commit to not raising taxes on the middle class if you win in 2012. I guarantee you he won't. If he does commit to that, then he's going to go the other route. Jack up corporate tax rates, which ultimately we pay, not the corporations, and a value-added tax. We could literally, as individuals, and now this would affect everybody, the poor and the wealthy, we could literally have the equivalent of a 20% raise in our income tax just with those two types of tax increases that wouldn't actually raise our income tax. But I believe that he wants to go after the income tax as well of the middle class and just directly tax us as well. And I think we'll see all three of those things happen. So now we're talking everybody's taxes could go up literally 25-30% after he's elected because he's got nothing to lose at that point. And people aren't going to be happy, but, you know, the liberals will just, the media will play it up. It's for the good. You know, everybody's got to, you know, everybody's got to sacrifice a little bit. Ambassador, was it the middle class that got us $14.5 trillion in debt? Was it rich people that got us $14? Was it corporations that got us $14.5 trillion in debt?
No, of course not. It was the government.
Yeah, but they want us to sacrifice.
Now,
he stood there and said it's time to eat our peas.
In fairness, the government was responding often to the demands of the people, some of whom were middle class. Once Johnson passed Medicare, that became an entitlement for the middle class.
Yeah.
Of course, it's an entitlement for other classes, too. But the middle class is the largest and most, at least until recently anyway, the largest and most productive of the classes in the country. And it was something for them because it does reach out and cover such a great mass of people.
Yeah.
It was ultimately unsustainable. Lyndon Johnson knew that at the time, of course. But, you know, he was practicing the old I'll be gone, you'll be gone strategy. By the time it gets that bad, I'll be dead, but we will have preserved government for the Democratic Party.
yeah.
It's a situation in which the people demand things. Politicians just naturally promise them more than they demand in order to best their rivals and get elected. And then they have to find some way to make good on at least some of those promises. But
yeah.
The only way to do that is to gather up more and more of the country's wealth into the hands of the government so they can redistribute it.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're now seeing us standing on the edge of the cliff that sort of policy inevitably leads to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you remember when I started my congressional campaign 3 years ago, it's hard to believe it was that long ago. Of course, everybody knows out there, I didn't win. But in any case, it was a real eye-opener and education for me. But my platform, right off the bat, was the Constitution. And I was telling people, we've got to get back to following the Constitution. And one of the speeches I used to give, I said, we as a nation have been asking the federal government to do things for us for far too long. And every time the federal government says, oh, yeah, we'll do that for you, we have to give up a piece of liberty. That's our armor, our shield, but we've been giving it away. That's the only way the government can do these things for us is for us to give up some liberty. Some people are more than happy to give up that liberty. And as you said, if we hit a real crisis, we may be willing to give it completely up. But there's no need for it. If we follow the Constitution, the protections are there. But a lot of these programs and things that have gone on in the past literally are unconstitutional and never should have happened to begin with. And the federal government never should have implemented a Medicare or Social Security system. You know, when FDR... His Department of Justice testified before Congress that the Congress said, hey, listen, this is an insurance program. The federal government doesn't have the authority to put together an insurance program. And what they argued before the court was it's not an insurance program, it's a tax, and it's going to go into the general fund. But when FDR told the American people about it, it was an insurance fund that would be segregated from the general fund, and it would have its own fund, and it would be secure. So he lied to the American people, just like this president's lying to the American people, and we did something that really was unconstitutional. So I do realize that the government does have the authority to tax, but this is a social program, and our founders made it very clear social programs were supposed to stay at the state level, and some states screw that stuff up, like California. Great. Then people can leave California and go somewhere else, or California can look at Texas and go, well, you know, they're doing a better job. Maybe we should follow their lead. But when the federal government screws it up, we have nowhere to go, nobody to turn to, and they just gather up more and more power. So that was just reminiscing a little bit about some of the speeches I used to give. And you basically said it all right there, Ambassador, that we may be headed for a crisis. You know, when Jefferson got elected – Henry Adams wrote in a book, History of the United States, 1801 to 1809, that Jefferson – now, Jefferson never said it this way, but this is Adams' interpretation of how Jefferson felt and the Republican Party felt. They felt that in Washington's second term, he became much more federalist-oriented, much more centralized government-oriented, and Adams was clearly very, you know, central government starts grabbing more and more power. He felt that Washington, and particularly Adams, wanted to create national crises so that they could crumble the government, and it was a very new government, and it would have been easier to do back then than, say, today, but it would have been easy to crumble the government, states go, oh, we're out of here, we're seceding, that kind of stuff, in order to build up, and this is Adams' quote, in order to build up a monarchy on its ruins. That's how Jefferson, that's how he perceived Jefferson felt, and the Republicans and the constructionists felt, was that the Federalists were trying to destroy our existing type of government. And, of course, Alexander Hamilton made it clear later on. He hated the government that we ended up with, and he wanted the northeastern states to secede, and he worked on that project for a while. But that's what, you know, was going on back then. Was it really the intent of the Federalists to destroy our Constitution and form of government to build up a monarchy on its ruins? I sort of doubt it.
I don't think so, because Washington was offered the presidency for life.
Yeah.
Had he wanted it, he could have taken it.
Exactly.
And he would have become a monarch in all but name. The fact that he turned it down, and turned it down specifically saying that we just fought a war to get rid of one king, we don't need another one, indicates to me that the leader of that movement, the most prominent American of the time, very, very clearly realized the danger of an overpowerful central government and categorically refused to be part of any such effort.
Yes. But it's interesting how there was still that feeling, that belief that that was going on back then, and it's here today, and we're talking about in the second term, the second president of our United States, Adams' term, people felt that way. And here we are. People think that things have changed over the course of history in the United States and things are different today. And, of course, the liberals would argue that, well, things are different today. That's why the Constitution doesn't really apply. It was the same back then. All you have to do is read history and see that most of the same arguments and problems were going on. Here we had a Constitution.
Human nature doesn't change.
Exactly.
We find different ways of expressing it, different philosophies. But at the core, it's really all about power.
Yeah, yep,
and,
that's it.
And about who holds it and how it's distributed, how it's wielded. You can call it communism, you can call it fascism, you can call it monarchism. It doesn't matter. It's all about centralizing the power. And, you know, you have to remember when you speak of the period of the Constitution and the founders and all the rest, that we were engaged in the most radical political experiment probably in the history of the planet at that stage. And philosophers all over Europe, the Enlightenment philosophers and others, were looking at what we were doing and saying, my God, can it work? No, it can't possibly work. Well, maybe it can work. And they were having the most profound arguments amongst themselves as to whether or not it would be possible, and if possible, how long it would last. You remember de Tocqueville's famous argument that it would last until such time as the masses discovered that through the power of the vote they could vote themselves money from the wealthier classes, at which point it would begin to collapse. There is a modern professor named Tyler who has done studies on democracies in the past and have concluded that the average length of any democracy is about 200 years, and we've now gone on 235, and he thinks we're in a stage that he would call apathy, which is well on the road to decline, and that we will collapse in due course. Who knows? He may be right. But I think that we still have it in us as a people and as a political system to fend this off if we will reach down inside ourselves and find the strengths that enabled us to create this country and sustain it in the first place. Where we are now, we have gotten ourselves through indolence and indifference and God knows what, corruption. Since World War II, we have gotten ourselves into a situation where we really are deeply threatened. Our whole way of life is deeply threatened. Our capacity to live and enjoy life as we have is deeply threatened, and there is no way out of it without pain. Politicians who tell you that they have a painless way to get us out of this mess are lying. We are all going to have to make sacrifices, and we won't like it. But if we don't make those sacrifices now, in a very few years, the problem will be so great, the pit that we will have dug for ourselves and which our leaders will dig deeper for us will be so great that we'll never, ever be able to get out. And we will look to our children and our grandchildren and they to theirs, and they'll talk about the period 1950, 1960, 1970, as a golden age, and it'll become almost mythological. God, things never could have been that good. They've got to be lying to us.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that way.
I think the general populace is willing to sacrifice and is willing to suffer. However,
I hope so.
What they want to see is the politicians and those on top suffering with us. If they are not going
to
compromise.
Absolutely. No, it has to be for everybody. If you're talking about an equal distribution of the wealth, let's talk about an equal distribution of pain. Because there's some coming.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, Albert Einstein, believe it or not, had a quote, fairly famous quote on the Constitution. Of course, later on in life, he became a dedicated socialist. I think maybe his mind was starting to go as smart as he was. But when he was a little bit younger, he said, "The strength of the Constitution lies entirely in the determination of each citizen to defend it. Only if every single citizen feels duty-bound to do his share in this defense are the constitutional rights secure." And so when you talk about the apathy that we may be in, Ambassador, I agree. You're right, everybody. It's going to take everybody unified. And Lincoln talked about the same sort of things in one of his speeches, that we have to be unified in defending and supporting the Constitution. If we're not, then we'll destroy ourselves.
I'm very much afraid that there's truth to that. And I just hope that we haven't had so many of us go down the road of indolence and greater dependence on government, that we can't yet unify ourselves as a self-sufficient people and once again find the strength within ourselves to revitalize and resurrect our country.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Tocqueville quote is a great one. I like that. And he also said, the American public, it's very along with similar lines, but the American Republic will endure until the day Congress. So you said people discover that they can vote themselves money. Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's own money. And that's really where we're at today.
They figured that out a long time ago.
Yeah, they did, exactly. That's been going on for a long, long time. So anyway, well, listen, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today, Ambassador. Before we let you go, I know you're a busy guy and you're involved in a lot of stuff. Let us know, first of all, is there any website or anything that you're involved in that people ought to know about and people can contact you or just see what your stuff you're working on, projects that you're working on?
Well, I can mention a couple of things very quickly. First of all, I write a political blog for, it's called The Guidepost, and it's written for an electronic newspaper which you can reach at nsbnews.net, nsbnews.net. Sadly, I don't get paid for writing this thing, but if anything I have said today is of interest to anyone, they can find more of the same by looking up The Guidepost on nsbnews.net. And then secondly, can I mention something about political parties on this? Can I plug for a political party on your on your show?
You can plug anything you want, Ambassador.
Okay, well, since coming back and retiring, I've become the strategy chairman for the Republican Party for Volusia County. There are now 6 Republican clubs in Volusia County, and I would urge all conservatives who want to band together, who want to act, who want to devote their time and their effort to defeating Obama and his Marxist minions and getting good conservative Republicans in power at the national level, at the state level, at the county level, to join those 6 clubs and work with me and with the rest of the Republican leadership in this county to organize to get out the vote in 2012.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
awesome.
You know, contact your local Republican club.
Yep, exactly. And any really get involved in any group out there. Now, some of these groups can, I've seen them start to become a little divisive over time. You know, maybe start your own group. Find some people that you can band together. But we really need to ultimately be unified in this. And if you're an independent out there and you're in a state like Florida, your vote won't count in the primary. You need to, you can tell people you're an independent. Just register as Republican so you can make a difference in the
Oh, absolutely.
In the next
listen
race.
For independents, too. All that matters is that you're conservative.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we Republicans are prepared to work with everyone who is conservative, who will vote for Republican candidates in the fall. Any Republican, for the purposes of this election, any Republican is better than any Democrat, because
yeah.
we have to have the votes in the Congress, in the House and the Senate, to organize the committees, to have the committee chairman, to have the leadership of each house to determine what legislation comes to the floor and what does not. In order to do that, we have to have majorities in both houses, and of course, we have to have a Republican president if we are to protect this country. The Democrats clearly won't do it. The Republicans are at least trainable. Let's get out there and let's put Republicans in office.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Well, your previous statement before I jumped in there, one of the people in the chat room with the handle GGT183 said, "Amen, Ambassador." Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to ask Paul if she has any final questions for you, Ambassador, and then Dick, and then if not, we'll let you go. But Paula, anything?
No
for the
final
ambassador?
Questions.
Okay, Dick, anything for the Ambassador?
I agree with what he said about the Republican Party. However, the Republican Party has to clean up its own act, has to weed out the rhinos and get them out of the party. Quit
yeah.
supporting rhinos. Find them and get rid of them.
Yeah, and that's really where the uninformed masses, if you can't reach them, and I learned this the hard way, if you can't reach them in a campaign, and I saw this happen around the country, typically the rhino gets elected. It's the one that has the most money, either the rich guy or the rhino, but that's a whole other story, and we've already talked about that in the past. But anyway, Ambassador Stanley Escudero, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure. We'll be in touch, of course, you know that, and tell your wife that we said hi. Have a great rest of the week and weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, Tom, it's really good talking to you, and you too, Dick. And Tom, let me know when you and Nancy are going to be in the area again. We'll get together for lunch or dinner or what have you, my treat.
We will. Well, oh boy, yeah. You don't have to do that, but we will. We're taking a little vacation in a couple weeks, well, in a week, going to Colorado for a few weeks, and then sometime after that, we'll be back up in the area to have some fun, and we'll definitely get together. So, any case,
LJ,
we said hi, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay.
It's good
you
listening to you,
care.
Ambassador. I love to listen to you talk.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, thank you, Dick. I appreciate that. And bye, Paula. Nice meeting you over the phone.
Nice meeting you as well, Ambassador.
Okay,
now to wrap up the show today, and I meant to do it in the beginning. Of course, the Ambassador called in, you know, right on time, so we got going right away. But Joan Flowers, everybody knows about Joan Flowers. We had a discussion with her on April 19th. We'll get her back on the show one of these days to talk about developments. But we're trying to get her father, Theodore Lovejoy, who has passed on and is buried in Chicago without a headstone, into Arlington. We know for a fact that he was discharged as a warrant officer in the United States Army at the end of World War II. He wasn't in for very many years, and to make warrant officer in that short a time, he would have had to have been doing quite good. The problem with getting into Arlington is there's some medal requirements, or you died in combat, et cetera. He doesn't meet those, but we know for a fact that black soldiers, for the most part, didn't get medals in World War II. Many of them in the Army didn't get medals when their white counterparts were getting medals. So it's no proof whatsoever that he doesn't deserve to be in Arlington. But the fact that he made warrant officer in just a few years is proof that he was somebody who was really at the top of his industry there in the Army, if you want to call it that, and amongst his colleagues. And for a black man to achieve that, even in combat, even in war, is really something quite special. Now, I got an email just yesterday, I believe, from Charles Sasser, and he wrote a book about the 761st, which was a tank brigade operated by black soldiers. And he told me that he interviewed a lot of the surviving soldiers from that era, and you know, got lots of names, et cetera, and Theodore Lovejoy's name never came up. So, but that's not proof necessarily. So, I think we're at a point now where what we're going to do is I'm going to use my contacts and I have pretty good contacts at the state level, not just the local, but the state level in the American Legion and VFW to see about through the legislative contacts in Washington, their contacts, to get this gentleman buried in Arlington, to just come up with a, whether it be just a little rider on a bill or whatever it is, just to make it happen, and then do a fundraiser to pay for the excavation and moving of him to Arlington. That's one thing. Even if the government says, yeah, we'll bury him in Arlington, we've got to get him there. So we're going to have to eventually do a fundraiser, but I think that's the way it's going to go. So first step now, or next step, is to just simply get it authorized. And we'll work through the American Legion, which has quite a bit of a lobbying capability to make that happen. I think we can do that. It's a worthwhile cause. But if anybody out there is interested in helping out Joan, she spent a lot of money since the Clinton administration trying to get her father buried in Arlington and was promised by the Clinton administration. And, of course, here we go, libs breaking their promises, but never happened. And she's worked with her one of her senators, little Dick Durbin. He is basically blown her off and not interested in helping out, although his office now is kind of dealing with her a little bit. But in any case, on the website, usaradionetwork.com, go to my page. There's an email there. It's the American Hour Show. I believe that's the email, at gmail.com, the American Hour Show at gmail.com. I'll get you in touch with Joan if you'd like to help her out. She spent a lot of money. She's been unemployed for a little bit of time here. And so, one, if anybody out there needs voiceover work, she's got a great, smooth, silky voice. You really would want to use her. Second of all, if you just feel like, you know, giving her a little donation just to help her get by, she's been struggling since all these years, spending all this money trying to get her father moved to Arlington. But we're going to do it for her. And so shoot me an email if you can help out in some way, or you know somebody and you have any contacts that can help us move this process along. But that's what's going on. There's the update for Joan Flowers, our good friend. And that's going to be it. Next week, we've got Jill Trammell and Craig Sawyer, call sign Sawman, Navy SEAL, and been involved in several projects now on the History Channel, are going to be filling in for me for the next 2 weeks, Monday and Wednesday of next week and the following week, while I go on vacation with my wife. And you don't want to miss that. They're going to do a series on the TSA whistleblowers and what they have told the government and the world about what's going on in the TSA and the incompetence and ineptitude that's going on there, as well as talking about the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation and how they're working with that to make a difference for our wounded warriors coming back. And they've already been doing that. They were just in Atlanta this last weekend, taking those guys around in Formula One cars, letting them drive Formula One cars, real Formula One cars, and out for a little shooting exercise, a little sniper practice and that kind of stuff. So Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation. They're great hosts. They're going to do a great job with the show. Jill used to be actually a TV reporter around the same time that I was in San Diego in the Navy, and also did some radio work. So they're fully prepared to run a good show. You don't want to miss it. I'll get that up on the website in the next couple days for next week and the week after. But Jill Trammell and Craig Sawyer, the Navy SEAL, and a war hero as well, that kind of stuff. So you don't want to miss it. All right. Any last words for us, Paula, before we call it a week?
Just a shout-out to our Air Force men and women serving overseas. Your families love and miss you and want you home soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yesterday your shout-out was the Navy. Thank you for that. I'm going to do that for the Navy, my branch of service, and, of course, the Marines. Marines kept us safe on our ships, and I love those guys. And, of course, we had Marine pilots, too, as well. Flying Navy and Marine aircraft, and that was great. So, boy, I tell you, sometimes I miss the military. I miss being in the military, but at least I still have all my old buddies that are still around, and we get together every now and then. And maybe one of these years I'll go back to Tailhook. They do it in Fallon, Nevada. Reno, Nevada now. And it's pretty mild compared to the old days. One of the reasons it kind of got shut down. You don't see too much of the active duty there anymore. It's all us old-timers that go and tell stories. And, of course, those tales get bigger and bigger every year. But it's fun to do. Anyway, all right, I got to wrap things up here, Paul, because I'll just keep talking. If we start talking about the military, I'll just keep going. Anyway, thanks, everybody, for listening today. We had fun. It was a pleasure. Paula, have a great weekend, and we'll see you in a few weeks.
Bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.